A sermon by Reverend Richard A. Rem, preached at Christ Community Church in Spring Lake, Michigan, on May 12, 1996, in the series I Do Believe, entitled Where Love Dwells, There is Family. The scripture readings are 1 Corinthians 13, John 11, verses 1 through 5, and chapter 12, verses 1 through 8. The texts for the sermon are 1 Corinthians 13, verse 8, and John 11, verse 1. Copyright, Grand Valley State University.
Well, this is Mother's Day, and there are purists in regard to worship who say we hadn't ought to observe it in worship because it's not one of the Christian holidays, not one of the festival days. And then there are those of a more cynical mind who say we ought not to observe it because it's just a commercial promotion to sell cards and flowers and things. And some also object to it because it can become rather sentimental and maudlin. But those who do such, who say such things, ought to know that which they are addressing. Mother's Day is big. So hail, mothers. I know when I'm up against an inevitable kind of tide. And as a matter of fact, when it is put in the proper perspective, is there any more beautiful intimate bonding in all the world than that of mother and child? And who of us will ever be able to make it up to our mothers? And so on Mother's Day 1996, let's focus not only on mothers, but on the whole aspect of family. There are some who have a more serious objection to a thoughtless celebration of Mother's Day in worship. That comes from a sensitivity to the fact that in a gathered assembly like this, there are all sorts and conditions of humankind. And we do tend on Mother's Day to move towards sentiment and perhaps lift up that happy family where there are smiles all around, mother, father, son, daughter. And as a matter of fact, there aren't so many perfect, ideal situations. And sometimes in the church, preachers like me might tend to suggest that perfect ideal family is the blessing of God, so that if you happen to be in a situation of brokenness, not only can this celebration create sadness, but it can as well add a load of guilt to that sadness. And therefore, I think that it's wise that we approach the subject rather cautiously and sensitively. But I do have a great word for you today. It is that where love dwells, there is family. And that means that without the neglect of a focus on the biological family, as a matter of fact, we as humankind are not shut up to that possibility, but we have also a greater possibility of transcending those blood ties and finding family where we discover love and respect and shared vision. The possibility then of human community, even beyond the biological family, because where love is, there is family. And I want to point that up this morning, that we do have that wonderful possibility of finding human community, which is so very critical for us all. And it is rather unfortunate in our day that the term family values has been co-opted by the conservative element of society that uses it to politicize its own social political agenda, so that family values, which we all would affirm, has become kind of a catchword or a flashpoint. But it's really interesting that if you think about family, there are not a lot of models in the New Testament. The one that one certainly wouldn't hold up on Mother's Day is Jesus. He wasn't a particularly good son in this rather naive and simplistic idea of what it means to be a good son. I could have read this morning from the third chapter of Mark, beginning with the 31st verse, which is a story where Jesus' mother and his brothers came to hail him and bring him home, because the rumor on the street was that he had gone off on the deep end and that he was somewhat mad. And so you remember they came to a house that was jammed and sent word in to him, and the word came, "Your mother is here." And he said, "My mother? Who is my mother?" And then he pointed to all those gathered about him. He said, "The one who does the word, that hears the word of God and does the will of God, is my mother and my brother and my sister." So Jesus was already pointing to that possibility, which I mention as the theme of this message, that there is a human community that transcends the biological family. But I didn't choose that text, but rather the couple of stories from John's Gospel, the story of Mary and Martha and Lazarus. This was a family. And it was a blood tie family, two sisters and a brother. Now, I don't know if they'd all been out on their own and had come back to keep house together, or whether, to the despair of their mother, they just never got married and did the normal thing. In any case, here they were, two brothers and two sisters and a brother. And even though they were tied by blood, they apparently had a warm and welcome home. They are not your conventional family, but they were family. But they were more than family. They were family that transcended those blood ties, as I pointed out a moment ago, because they were open to Jesus. When he came to Jerusalem, Bethany being just outside, he apparently made his home there. And they were family to him. When Lazarus got seriously ill, they sent for Jesus. His sisters did, out of concern for him. And they said of Lazarus, "The one whom you love." So there was an intimate connection between Jesus and this family. And the gospel writer tells us Jesus loved Martha and Mary. And then the other instance, his last journey to Jerusalem, coming again to their home, a dinner party given by Martha. And Mary breaks very expensive ointment, perfume, over his feet, to the criticism of Judas Iscariot. But she does it as an expression of love, and love does extravagant things. I hope all of you children have given to your mothers today something totally impractical. I mean, not like coupons to the car wash or a new set of dish towels. Come on now. Love does extravagant things. And obviously, that was the ambience of this home in Bethany. Jesus needed that because it was true of him, as I said a moment ago. There was tension in his biological family. Well, let's be honest. We don't get to choose our parents. And we may be responsible for our children, but it's kind of luck of the draw. And what's to be said about our brothers and sisters? We are given to each other, and we have to put up with each other. And we don't always like each other. And there are often tensions within the family. We smile on the outside, but you ought to hear us when we get together on the inside. Strong front to the world, tear each other apart inside when we get alone. Well, that may be too strong a statement, but you know what I mean. Jesus, he embarrassed his mother. She was going to bring him home. And his brothers agreed. They didn't like the word that was out on the street. I can identify with that. My name is a four-letter word. But even though it's a four-letter word, it's misspelled as often as it's spelled correctly. And I got a dear old aunt in Kalamazoo who breathes a little easier every time the Kalamazoo Gazette has another headline spelled R-E-H-M. She figures nobody's going to identify her with me, you see? So, we have to put up with our families, and that's not always easy. Nonetheless, we don't have to live only in our families either. In fact, a healthy family will be about creating mature and independent children. And that's what I really want to say to you this morning, that a good, healthy family will be about the creation within the children of a strong sense of identity that will give them an emotional center within themselves, enabling them to move out from us and to have their own center in their own being. There is a fine article some few years ago in the Atlantic Monthly on family systems theory. And this is, I guess, somewhat of a relatively new approach to human personality, in contrast to Freud, who isolated the individual and probed the depths of the unconscious. Family systems theory tends to see the individual in all of those respective interlocking relationships in which one lives. To understand the person in terms of the context and the human community of which he or she is a part. And family systems theory assumes that there is within the individual something instinctual that propels the individual into or toward independency. They assume as well that there is an instinctual basis for a movement back to togetherness. But it's understandable that unless one has achieved a kind of independence, a kind of identity out there, one will not be able to come back into community voluntarily and with delight. And so family systems theory points to the need for differentiation. That's the term they use. The emotional separation from parents, from the biological family. That's not a denigration of the family. It is a recognition that a healthy family will be about enabling children to find themselves and to be independent emotionally in order that they might have the center in themselves from which center they can come back to the family. Ideally, that's the way that it ought to work. I have a description here of such an ideal situation. He begins growing away from his parents in infancy and becomes an inner-directed adult. While always sure of his beliefs and convictions, he is not dogmatic or fixed in his thinking. Capable of hearing and evaluating the viewpoint of others, he can discard old beliefs in favor of new ones. He can listen without reacting and can communicate without antagonizing others. He is secure within himself and his functioning is not affected by praise or criticism. He can respect the identity of another without becoming critical or emotionally involved in trying to modify the person's life course. That's a fine ideal. That's a goal worth striving for in the family, to produce people like that. To produce people who have enough emotional security and independence that they can live confidently in their own skin and relate in a positive manner to those about them. None of us fulfills that ideal fully, obviously. We all fall short of it frequently. And I think particularly in the family, we're in tension with that goal. I mean, I'm a parent. And one is always a parent. You don't get over that role to the distress of your children. Where I've run up against that most often is in relationship to the church. One of my favorite stories that I've told before is about the young woman who joined Christ Community in the 70s when everything was breaking loose and erupting, and it seemed that every Sunday we had something else happening and people almost didn't want to miss because they didn't want to miss what would happen next. This young lady came to us from another denomination and came up to me one Sunday and she said, "What's happening next week?" And I said, "Gee, nothing special." She said, "Oh, good, my mother's coming." And I know how many of you have joined this community of faith with a bad conscience. Like, "Don't tell my mother." We have been on the cutting edge for a long time. And there have been those who have felt the long shadow of their parent over them as they knelt to say, "I do." That is pretty normal, because in the biological family, parents are always parents. And I suppose that's all right. As long as we really know that what our job is to love, to trust, and to let them go. To create individuals self-centered, secure, emotionally stable, able then with delight to come back and to love us as well. Well, last week I said to you that in these couple of weeks, I can't hardly preach without some reference to our immediate situation, and I can't think about the family and the kind of people families ought to be creating without thinking of the family of faith. Because as a matter of fact, a congregation is just an extended family. It is a place where love dwells, and it is family. And I believe that a congregation also ought to be about the creation of strong, independent people who have their spiritual, moral center in themselves and who can fly and soar like the eagles rather than being characterized as sheep who simply follow along. A few years ago, James Fowler wrote a book, Stages of Faith. He did what Eric Erickson did in the educational developmental process, and Lawrence Kohlberg did in the matter of moral development. James Fowler analyzed the stages of faith. And one of the things that struck me in that study was that Fowler maintained that very, very many traditional congregations are not about producing spiritual people who are independent and secure, but actually, intentionally or unconsciously, are about the stultifying of spiritual growth in the individual. Because you see, if spiritual development is arrested, then people are more like sheep, more easily controlled. And if religious institutions have been into anything historically, it is control. When I read that in Fowler, I knew that it was true of the institution, of pastoral leaders like myself. You know, you're not so much bothered if you just don't think. But as a matter of fact, we've been about something different for 25 years. When I think of this congregation, I know there's been something different about it a long time before I came here. I got a wonderful letter from a gentleman in his 80s, Dr. James Nettinga. Dr. Nettinga sent a sermon to me that he preached in his 80th birthday. Dr. Nettinga's great-grandfather and his grandfather were pastors here around the turn of the century. This congregation was founded by people who had a vision, who looked into the future, and old Dr. Nettinga, in his 80th year, preached a whale of a sermon about the possibilities and the positive aspects of life in the decade of the 80s. It's a marvelous sermon. One of these days, I'm going to reproduce it in the Courier for you. I thought to myself, you know, it's been going on in Spring Lake for a long time. When I came back here in 71, I'd only been here 3 months when this congregation changed its name from the First Reformed Church to Christ Community. I'd only been back here 3 months. Now, you can't accuse me of brainwashing this people in 3 months. I mean, we had a summer congregational meeting. The vote was 120 yes to 4 no to change a name of 101 years. And why did we change the name? Because we saw it was reasonable and responsible. The name Reformed had become a label. It had a great tradition. It was the Church of Jesus Christ, reformed according to the Word of God. But after 400, 500 years, what did it mean? It meant another denomination, another church structure. The name had lost the image-creating power of its origin. And we knew it would be responsible to change it because we knew that the rising generation was going to be less and less impressed with church labels. And so we changed the name to Christ Community, honoring the tradition of the Reformation with no intention ever of leaving the Reformed Church in America. And being faced with the choice we're faced with now, it creates pain for some who have long roots in that RCA, and that's regrettable. But when I think about this congregation, I realize that the majority of you made a different choice over the years, because I think a majority of you have come from some other faith family. In other words, you recognized, in terms of congregational life, what I've been saying about the biological family. No longer is the church of our birth or the family of our birth our destiny. We are people now who look for love, respect, and shared vision. And we make decisions and choices on that basis. And this congregation is full of people who have opted for a certain kind of community over allegiance to an ecclesiastical structure. And I happen to think that's what congregations ought to be doing, creating people who are not sheep, but rather people of strong independence, who are on a spiritual pilgrimage, who are growing and delighting in the grace of God, and who look for others of common faith, sharing a common grace with a common shared vision. The wonder is that in this day, we have the possibility of choosing and deciding and of opting for life, for the future, for a dream, losing not much, but gaining so much, because where love is, there is family.